Major Aikman, Reel 3. We're talking about when you actually, the channel crossing, or rather the embarkation, and you're saying there was an amusing story, if you'd continue.
When we mobilised, not only, of course, did we receive all the extra men and officers that we required to bring us up to establishment, and also the necessary guns and equipment, military equipment, but also vehicles. And some of these were civilian vehicles that were impressed, and therefore they had to be painted into service colours, and these civilian vehicles had to be adapted to meet our requirement. And I can certainly remember that one of the civilian vehicles did not have the floor loading that for shells, because one shell fell straight through the floor onto the ground underneath.
What do you remember about the crossing then?
Well, when we crossed, we went.
Did you go to did you go via Avonmouth or did you go?
No, the Avonmouth was where the vehicles went from,
you
and the guns.
Go with
I was not with them. I went and the night before, or the day or two before, all the officers were visiting. The regular soldiery, regular officers, tend to live in the south of Britain. And so at this time, they were all visiting their aunts, fathers, or whatever else, and left in the mess. There was me, who was the duty officer. There was the padre, who's had been mobilised from a parish in Wales, and the chap in charge of the repair workshop, whose civilian job was working in the railway workshops in Crewe. We were the three in the mess. And I suggested that it being dusk, that we should walk across the line of a light railway that had been used in the First War and was still visible on the ground, and that we should walk across from the camp where we were in to Stonehenge and have a look at Stonehenge in the moonlight. And so the three of us did. And one of the things that had happened that year was that there had been a lot of repainting huts on the Salisbury Plain, and some mischievous young subalterns celebrating their commissioning had painted the stones with the appropriate War Department colouring, and the War Department had taken special steps to deal with this. And so we found when we were watching, when we were walking around the Stonehenge out of a small hut, some infuriated War Department, or I'm not sure whether they were War Department, they wouldn't be War Department, they were Ministry of something or other, guards came to protest and demand our names, and we were going to be reported to the Brigadier Royal Artillery Southern Command, which only one of us was an artilleryman, and I knew I wasn't going to be in there for more than a day or two longer, so it didn't worry me too much. After they had been going on for a while, the padre unbuttoned his collar, demonstrating his clerical collar, which quietened them down more than somewhat, and they went into their other mode of, and this is the heel stone, and on Midsummer's Day the sun goes down here, and whatever, which was quite a change of word, and then but that was an amusement. We went to France, and
what day did you go? Roughly what date? September?
Oh, it was certainly in September, yes, it would be early in September. I don't know the date, I'm afraid.
What do you remember of the whole process of the Channel crossing? Or was there anything?
Well, we went at night, and I remember that I succeeded in sleeping in the cabin of the cross-channel steamer, and then we caught the train, the concentration area was in the Le Mans Laval area. And after we got out of the train, we marched for a few miles to the village where our guns and vehicles had already arrived.
Do you know the name of the village?
No, I don't.
The Le Mans area.
Well, the area was Le Mans and Laval. It would be in that area where the artillery of the BEF concentrated. And at that stage, we were billeted on French villagers.
Now, could you describe the billets you had and how you got on with the French up if they were still living in there with
yeah,
you?
Yeah, the French were there. The soldiers, of course, had not experienced the opportunity of cheap alcohol, and rapidly too many people got drunk. And I can remember the Sergeant Major being furious about this and reproving. I can remember that I also went out with some of the subalterns and drank more alcohol than it was certainly my habit. And
what were the estaminets like, or bars?
Fairly ordinary, I suppose. I have no real picture that they were just a room with chairs and no particular.
Were you not used to wine? Was that?
I don't think we weren't into wine. I don't think. I don't recall any wine. The drinking was. The brandies and the beers, and I don't recall any wine.
Now, what about your billet? That's what was your billet like? Your billet. Can you remember who you were with, or what it was like?
I remember at this stage of the war. Remember, we were there for a day or two only before we moved as a unit with vehicles and guns up to the concentration area on the Belgian frontier, and at that stage, I and 30 soldiers and one warrant officer were dispatched to a base camp near Saint-Nazaire in a place called Guerande. G-U-E-R-A-N-D-E. It was in Brittany. It was a walled town that boasted that it had been besieged 9 times and had not surrendered. And I remember thinking to myself, I hope that it's not going to break its record. And I was billeted in the house of the widow of a French colonel. And I was perfectly comfortably looked after. And the officers of this base camp used a civilian contractor to provide the food. And there were those who were complaining about the frequency with which oysters were provided. I was not in the habit of eating oysters and took them as an interesting feature of diet. We were there for 10 days, perhaps, and then moved.
What were you doing there?
Not a great deal, I don't think. There was a certain amount of training going on of anti-gas and the like.
What do you remember of that, anti-gas training?
Not really too much. There's the theoretical stuff and there's the practical stuff, but it wasn't a complicated thing. We were then moved from Guerande to another place on the coast, whose name at the moment is lost to me, where we stayed in a hotel which the wife of the owner was English. And the soldiers were in tents. My Sergeant Major would march the soldiers, and every day I saw them off as they marched their 20 miles or whatever it was, which was what they did around the flat land where salt is made, the big resort there was La Baule, L-A-B-A-U-L-E, which was where the wealthy Brazilians would go for relaxation, and so far as we were concerned, it was a place that we could go to and hire a bathroom, and we went to use the facilities of the upmarket hotels and their baths. This is not a long period of time. It was not long before I made the long rail journey from La Baule to Amiens and Arras, where I rejoined my unit, which was by then had established itself on the Belgian frontier.
At Amiens.
Well, beyond Amiens. Amiens was in the. It was close to the frontier, and so I was in areas where there were windmills. I remember, and the French controlling their windmills was intrigued me a little. And
now, when would this move take place? You rejoin the unit?
Well, I rejoined the unit by going by rail.
Would that be October or? Roughly.
It's certainly before, probably October, might even have been in November, certainly well before Christmas. At that stage, joining the regiment, regiments were provided with interpreters on a scale of 2 per major unit, and these were people who taught English at grammar schools or polytechnics or whatever. And I can remember going into Lille on a matter of business with one of the other subaltern in the battery, and we took the interpreter with us. And I can remember that we were in the lounge of a large hotel where people were drinking their morning coffee in groups of 2s and 3s and 4s, ladies and the like, and the interpreter pointed out to us that it was a normal pattern in a French hotel to provide prostitutes for the benefit of the customers, but that we would of course not be approached by them. The drill was you sat at one of the seats on the bar at the end of the room, and if you were to sit there, one of the ladies would come and see if she could find something that you wanted. And certainly while we were there, we saw exactly what the Frenchman had said. We saw the thing did work, which was interesting. I was familiar with the operation of the French brothels to the degree that one of the chores of the officer is censoring the suit's mail. And so I read quite a bit about the brothels, both down in Saint-Nazaire, Nantes, and also in Lille.
What was it? Tell me about censoring the mail. How much of a task was it, and what were you looking for?
Well, there were a number of things. The things that you were there to see was that there was nothing that would indicate where the unit was or what the unit was intending to do. And so, providing the chap talked about the weather in the country without too much detail.
Did you find it embarrassing censoring the men's letters?
Not really, no. There was one soldier who was very concerned that his letter had been cut out part of, and I got him to send it back so that I could see it, and I found he was very reluctant to show it to me, and when I did, the bits that had been cut out manifestly ought to have been cut out, because he was certainly talking about things that he should not have done and he knew he should not have been doing.
Were you aware of the codes that some of them were employing?
These words like swalk and do you mean this kind of thing?
No, I mean that some of them had special codes for different parts of France. Others started letters, the different words started different sentences.
They weren't into that level of, as far as I know, they weren't into that level of communication. It wouldn't arise. At this time, I think I mentioned before, I was attached to a French artillery regiment.
Again, this is when that happened, was it?
No, really.
Before
I mean,
Christmas?
It would be after Christmas.
How then? What were you doing sort of between October or early November and Christmas on the Belgian frontier? What exactly was the unit doing?
Well, the unit was rehearsing its army drills, communication drills, and movement drills. We were we practiced moving, and we did exercises on the Somme. So that we were practicing, because we knew that as soon as the battle started, one of the first things we would have to do would be to up and move ourselves into new positions. And so this was a thing that we rehearsed and trained ourselves to do, just as we had been doing before the war, but now we had the full mobilisation kit to do it with. So there was that kind of thing to do.
And this was still your main responsibility, movement?
My main responsibility was movement. In January, I was sent back to Britain for 3 weeks to the artillery training school in Lark Hill.
This is before you went to the French unit, then?
Don't remember, probably.
What about Christmas? Was there any special Christmas celebrations?
Well, yes. We were aware of Christmas and made some gestures to it, but there was no great...
Did you have the sort of army tradition of the officers serving the men and that, all that kind of thing? Or was
I
it
don't,
not a union?
I don't remember that in relation to France. I don't remember that.
Okay, so this course, when you went back, let's deal with that then. This was in January. What did the course consist of? What were you being taught?
That was basic artillery training. It was obviously a course that had been organised for officers like myself who had not been through the regular army training. And so I was taken through the basic skills required of an officer. And so we were... doing field firing and using the artillery ranges of Lark Hill and the skills that were required.
It was based between Woolwich and Lark Hill, was it? Or
it was at Lark Hill.
Oh, it's at Lark, sorry.
Lark Hill.
What exactly were you learning then, in the sense of, I mean, what about them? Were you actually learning the mathematics of gunnery?
Well, there isn't a great deal of mathematics to learn. You've got the tactical things to learn. You've got to decide how you control fire. The mathematics are fairly straightforward in the English system. You've got a range tables, and the range tables you look up for every degree of pressure change or temperature change or the various things. You simply apply it in terms of adding a number of yards to the range that you order. Now, this was, I found, very different when I did my attachment to the French artillery.
Hang on. What about there was quite a lot of trigonometry in establishing the firing lines.
Yes, that I had done on the Lark Hill ranges when, in peacetime, I had done that. I had found that Salisbury Cathedral is an invaluable thing because you can see it from all over the place, and it's a very useful marker for your trigonometry.
And so had they taught you OP skills, or the art of bracketing?
Well, the OP skills were the work that I was doing on this course at Lark Hill. No doubt there was also more trigonometry at that time too, and the use of directors and theodolites. But that would be done then.
And how long was this course?
3 weeks.
So not long to learn all this.
Oh, I know, you learn a lot in 3 weeks about, get fairly exhausting subject. I mean, it isn't, as they say, rocket science.
Now, when you got back, this is when you probably, most likely, went on to your detachment to the French artillery unit. That sounds very interesting. Could you tell us a bit about that, the background to it and what happened?
One of the things that Wen did to fill the time in was to do a various sorts of training, and one of the attachments to French artillery units, and I was sent with two or three other officers and the senior interpreter to a French artillery regiment. There was a fair degree of misunderstanding in this because the French artillery officer is thoroughly trained on things to do with science and mathematics and physics and chemistry and whatever. They were somewhat taken aback to find a young man like I was, they did cheer up when they found I was at Oxford University. When they found I was studying philosophy, politics and economics and not the proper subject, they lost interest again. I, for my part, was not really understanding these French gunners who were expecting to go to war with the Germans shortly with 6-inch guns drawn by teams of horses. Which seemed to me to be an improbable situation. So there was a fair degree of misunderstanding between us on the matters technical. The interpreter, of course, was not a great deal of use because he didn't understand British artillery expressions any more than he understood French ones. So we were reduced to our schoolboy French, But I found the French were very welcoming. It's a very different sort of army to ours. I was,
in what way?
I was surprised to find that... the number one on the gun, his civilian employment, was that of parish priest, which is not the kind of thing that I'm accustomed to with my padres. I think that's probably enough of that. happened.
Okay, well, so what happened next? And this moving to, we're through now January, February-ish time, 1940. What's the next thing you remember?
Well, we
still in the border, the French, the Belgian border.
It was a time for exercises of various sorts. As I think I mentioned that we did an exercise on the Somme. There was a good deal of training and rehearsing of movement, so that one would be thoroughly confident and about. And also one was doing a certain amount of study of maps that one would understand where one was going to go to when we moved, and the intention was that we would move onto the line of the River Wavre, W-A-V-R-E. And duly, when the war broke out...
The real war. Tell me about the operations in Belgium. How did they start? What was the first you knew about it?
Well, as soon as we knew that D-Day had arrived, although, of course, in those days, in order to conform with the French, it was a J-Day, because everything was worked on jour, not days. When we knew when J-Day was... we moved. The regiment moved through the suburbs of Brussels, and there were cheering crowds to greet us as we went through the suburbs of Brussels. A few days later, when we came back through Brussels, we did not receive the same treatment, I'm afraid. We took our places on the river line, and I remember that when the Germans came to the river, there was the...
What were the positions like? Could you describe how you prepared your positions? I mean, presumably you actually dug weapons pit, gun pits and sort of dropped into position properly.
Yes.
Could you describe a bit of that procedure and what the gun pits would be like, that kind of thing?
The gun pits were not elaborate. We were not expecting to be long in position. It was an encounter battle. So, therefore, you were not going to put yourself into a position where you could not get your guns out readily and quickly. So it was... and remember, we're not talking about frontline position. We're talking about some thousands of... behind the four defended localities. So it's a fairly open situation. There's a tendency that when the area for the deployment of the artillery... heavy artillery always seemed to coincide with the same area that people had chosen to put their hospitals in. In fact, there was a certain amount of wry jesting between the doctors of the hospital service and ourselves that we always seemed to put ourselves in the same location. Presumably, there was the same requirements for sighting that met both patterns.
You're not making some cynical observation that we were putting the heavy guns where they'd be almost secure, as the Germans wouldn't fire the hospitals.
I don't think the Germans would have any such compunction.
I'm just making clear that you're not saying that.
One of my vivid memories of the battle is of watching a dive bomber bombing a civilian hospital in Armentières, a flat modern building with a very flamboyant Red Cross, and the Stuka dive time after time, with the screaming of the Stuka going down and the screaming bombs as they went into the hospital. I can assure you that the Germans would have had no compunction. It was just that, perversely, when you look at the map and decide where would be a good place to put a field hospital, it tends to be the same place as we could put your 6-inch artillery or 8-inch artillery.
So how long were you in these in the line, almost immediately then, when you'd run into the Germans? Was it?
The Germans arrived about the same time as we did. The first contact, when the German troops reached the river line, they fired at the dusk a very signal to show where they were, and so that you could see where the Germans had got to by watching the lights going up. And as I said before, the Germans were still using balloons to hoist their observation post from, and so you were seeing these balloons that were viewing the battle scene. But we weren't in position for very long, because it was not very long before the Germans had turned the line and we were moving now.
So they didn't attack the positions on the wall,
it was the French army that the Germans went through, and we were therefore moving sideways across Belgium towards places like, towards Ypres eventually, taking a number of positions on the way.
Were you actually in action, or were you just taking up positions and then withdrawing?
We did take the guns were used. The 8-inch guns were used mainly for harassing fire on lines of communication, and so therefore you would be firing at a crossroads or whatever, out of sight, on some time plan, so as to deter people from using that road.
Now, as you retreated, what problems did you encounter? I'm thinking in particular of the possibility of German air attacks, civilian refugees, and problems with stores, lines of communication stuff.
Well, the civilians were obviously, you saw the civilian refugees crowding along the road. They presented no particular problem to us. I mean, they had their own problems and we had ours, and
they didn't block the road then?
No, they didn't block the road. Where you tended to get the blocking of the road was when units were crossing lines or whatever for whatever reason. I can remember a particular difficulty with a lighter artillery unit that was being towed by tracked vehicles, and I can remember them getting in the way. I can remember also difficulties with my 8-inch gun falling through the roadway. These are all the problems of movement. I don't remember a great deal of difficulty with the German aircraft. I think we were well protected from that. It wasn't until we were close to Dunkirk that I can remember German aircraft.
Now, well protected by whom? By the RAF, I presume.
Well, or by anti-aircraft, or both. We were left alone from that point of view. We were not on their missions statements, perhaps.
And what about, were you able to get sufficient food stored? Well, food,
yes,
and fuel?
Food and fuel presented no problem, no. There was everything that we wanted was there, and came, and supplies came. I don't remember that there was anything. It was very much like Southern Command manoeuvres in before the war. The whole thing worked. There were, as I say, the problems that one got when you had one line of soldiers moving across another, and there was the intersection problem. And there was certainly one occasion at night when there was a crossroads that we had to use that was obviously being shelled to inhibit people using it, and you could count the number of seconds from one shell to the next and work out whether it was going to be close to you as you went by.
Was that your first time under fire then?
And all over, I mean, through this, that was not particularly the first time. There had been other occasions on which bombing had occurred, and I told you of this episode in Armentières where the hospital was bombed. There were German bombs. I can remember a village with low-flying hostile aircraft, and I can remember being among those who ran to take protection to get out of the way of the low-flying aeroplanes and their machine guns and bombs. But yes, that sort of thing was occurring in the